Hoser on Fire, Episode 61.
Welcome to the Composer on Fire podcast with your host and coach, Garrett Hope, where he teaches you what it takes to master the business of composition by interviewing the best and most creative minds. These interviews are master classes by world-class composers, performers, teachers, and business leaders condensing many years of experience and tough lessons into a weekly show. This is the show Garrett wishes he had when he started composing. This show is about you, and Garrett is here to help you master the business of composition. Make sure to stay up to date with everything going on at Composer on Fire by signing up for the free newsletter at composeronfire.com. And now, for this episode of Composer on Fire.
We all have something different to say that's us, and if we weren't, we'd be in the wrong business. So nobody is your competition. And in terms of job scarcity and all that, give it up. Don't worry about it. That's only if you're looking at a very limited blinders-on view of the world of what it is to have a job. How about creating your job? How about creating your business?
I think so much of what needs to happen is more openness within our community as composers.
Yeah.
For too long, there's been secrets. Composers have figured it out in quotation marks, and then that's their kind of trade secret.
But there's the first mistake. No one's figured it
out. Nobody has. We're all in process.
If you think you have figured it out, you're full of it.
Yeah. Well, and the more we can share and build community and trust, the more we can just make it better for everybody.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's the arts. What's a more beautiful, wonderful thing to share than the arts? We want everybody to do well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that I think is so important is to become part of your community by volunteering your time, if you have any time at all. If you're raising three kids, it's a little hard. But if you're not raising three kids, maybe you have time to be able to, you know, to
You've got to give back.
Or just give. I never even think of it as giving back. I just think of it as give. Just be part of something that helps other people.
Mm-hmm.
You
know? We had mentioned earlier, you had brought it up, the idea of competition and abundance and scarcity. This kind of goes into what we were just saying, yeah. But so many composers and artists and people in general view life as scarce of resources.
Mm.
Can you share with us your view of that and how, what does that mean to have an abundance mentality as a composer?
It means that you realize that there's opportunity wherever you seek it, act on it, create it, initiate it, follow through on it. That it is just such a mistake and such a sad thing to limit oneself by presuming that the deck is stacked against you before you've even started. So many people I've heard say, whether they're going in for an audition and they say, oh, I'm probably not going to win this, but I'm going to do it anyway. So they're shooting themselves in the foot psychologically before they've even picked up their instrument to go behind the curtain and play. So many people I've heard say, oh, I'm sure I'm not going to win this competition, but I'm going to, you know, do it anyway. Well, why do you have to shoot yourself down emotionally and psychologically before you even try to do something? Talk about sending the universe mixed messages and sending yourself, you know, forget about the universe. This is about you. You know, you're sending yourself very mixed messages at this point. On one hand, you're spending a lot of time and effort to attempt to do something. On the other hand, you're convincing yourself that it's all pointless and you're not going to win. Gee, that doesn't sound like a good idea. I can think of happier ways to approach this. So instead, anything we do should be done with a sense of wonder, joy, and possibility, you know? Yeah. And just, I don't want to sound like Marianne Williamson. I don't listen to her. I don't know any of these, you know, self-help people. But I realize that wonder, joy, and possibility could be the next bestseller on the airport paperback rack. I think so much of what we do has to do with mindset. Everybody knows this. You put yourself in, it's the same way that you put yourself in the mindset to compose when you sit down to compose, when you realize that you're carving out your day to allow time to compose. And that doesn't mean that anything's going to hit the page for the first 2 hours. It means you're going to pace back and forth, make endless cups of tea, pet the cat, vacuum, all kinds of things. But it's your composing time. And when you finally do sit down in that chunk of time of composing, 2 hours of which you've done a lot of non-composing, that third hour can be magic, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's composing. That's it. non-composers who live with us watch this and crack up. I mean, there are so many things. I give a medal to anybody who lives with a composer. I just have to say that because
you should talk to my wife. Yeah,
yeah, we're just weird. But that's, you know, part of the process, and I take great joy in that. I no longer think it's weird. I just realized this is part of my process. I'm not going to feel guilty of it. I make more cups of tea during the day when I'm working. So I'm like the best hydrated composer ever. And then it morphs into something a little mm-hmm. stronger after 5 o'clock.
As a coach, one of the things that I have to keep reminding of myself and remind people that I work with, what you focus on grows.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right.
And when all you think and see is, I'm not going to do this. Yeah. I can't do this. Why am I even submitting?
Right.
You will get that.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
It totally is.
Anything you think. And this is true in all parts of your life, not just the musical ones. It's true with love. It's true with life and friendships, everything. Just the way you are in the world. If you are what we tend to see, if you notice that people who are negative, they get more negativity because
yes.
they are pessimistic and they don't think anything's going to go right. And so guess what? More and more things don't go right.
And people treat them negatively
right.
because they're negative.
That's right.
Yeah.
Whereas those of us who are, you know, rather cheery and, you know, figure, well, this may not go right, but the next thing's going to be great. You know, so nothing can stop us. We're just sort of out there in the world just bumbling along happily. That's my motto. And as a result, everything seems to go wonderfully a lot of the time just because you're putting that out there. And additionally, it's sort of fun for other people to be around because you're not a drag. You're basically an upbeat person who figures, well, you know, if not this thing, the next thing, but I'm going to put my best foot forward. And the other thing which this leads to is something that I kind of wanted to talk about is the concept, because it's been very big in my life, taking risks, going to the place where you're uncomfortable and making yourself go there and being rewarded wonderfully for that. There have been quite a number of times in my life when I've taken ridiculous risks, and virtually every one of them has turned out spectacularly in a way that I never would have even imagined. So I want to encourage our peers to push yourselves, and when something comes down the pike that's really out of your comfort zone, go for it. I mean, you know, unless it's like illegal. If someone's asking you to help them with that 7-Eleven armed robbery, maybe not. Although it would be a great way to get new music on the news, on the nightly news. But other than that, maybe you should say no to that kind of risk taking. But in general, you know, when you take a risk, when you do something that makes you uncomfortable, that is usually a really good thing, and whole new worlds become discovered. Mm-hmm. And what I found is that then you start to become comfortable with it, and you start to feel really good about it, and you maybe have a very different take on that world than anybody else does, and boom, you know? It's very important to push yourself.
Risk-taking is difficult and challenging because it's fearful.
Right.
Right? And this gets back to the scarcity and abundance because of competition. And so many of us look at our peers, even we go to the same school, mm-hmm. or people we know, and we're like, okay, we're all applying for the same jobs and grants, and we are all want the same commissions. And I think we need to switch that.
Oh, big time.
And if we stand together and we can help each other and show our scores and process and become masterminds with each other,
absolutely.
Wouldn't it be better?
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is how, you know, Stephen Paulus and Libby Larson started the Composers Forum, the Minnesota Composers Forum all those years ago, 30 some odd years ago.
Right.
It's by saying, let's band together and help each other, and let's put on concerts of our music, and let's do advocacy for our peers. And that, of course, you know, years later became the American Composers Forum. It's a very important thing. The other thing is this whole thing of competition. I think that is one of the dirtiest words out there. I got to tell you, I bristle at the word because... my whole life, and I hope other people's approach, is create your opportunity. Go mm-hmm. out and create the opportunity. Don't wait passively for something to which you can apply and maybe, you know, grace them with your $25 or more, God forbid. You know, don't buy into that stuff. There are so many other ways to create opportunities for yourself that are going to be even more rewarding than if you were to win this one competition and get one little performance someplace, you know, somewhere in the country. There are so many better ways to do business and to run your life as a composer, to make yourself feel good about what you're doing. Mm-hmm. I don't think it feels good because, you know, 15 years ago, I was entering competitions and stuff. I don't think that felt good. I felt I don't like being in the position, kind of like a kid trying to get an allowance out of their parent. I don't like having my hand out trying to get chosen, to be selected by some force beyond my abilities, beyond my powers. I don't like not being in control. And the greatest way to be in control is to simply be in control and decide mm-hmm. what you want your career to look like, what you want to do, start making that music, get it out there, create it, be proactive, and stop thinking that there's competition. I've never felt an ounce of competition with anybody else. There are so many people who are technically better than me and certainly far more successful, and I think that's great, and that just inspires me. Are they my competition? Not at all. And the reason is because I have something very different to say than they do, and other people have very different things to say than I do. Nobody is in competition. The reason we are art music composers is because each one of us is a snowflake. You know, we all are a little different. We're all unique. We all have something different to say that's us. And if we weren't, we'd be in the wrong business. The reason to be in the arts is because you have something personal to share with the world. So nobody is your competition. And in terms of job scarcity and all that, give it up. Don't worry about it. That's only if you're looking at a very limited blinders-on view of the world of what it is to have a job. How about creating your job? How about creating your business?
Thank you.
The opportunities. Stop waiting to have things handed to you or applying for things. These are passive things over which you have no control.
Take action.
And to be honest, I feel the same way about grants. Grants are great. If you can get them, terrific. But you cannot plan your budget on grants.
You called them in one blog post the composer's lottery.
Yeah. It's true. It's fine if you want to. I've certainly received a few in the past. Not for many years. I don't apply for grants. I haven't applied for anything in years. But I really, really caution people to get too wrapped up in this competition and grant world, which is, it's a creature of the academia world. And that's its other can of worms, because there is much that is wonderful to say about an education and about academia. And there's also much that's not so wonderful, because it's a world that often has blinders on. Now, many schools are trying to change that. And one of the areas that we see this is with business of music classes, right? They're trying to expand and give their graduates the tools by which they can actually apply all the wonderful musicianship that they have learned while they were in school. That is the least that a school can do, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, that it's been criminal in a sense that until now, schools haven't done that, because you're flinging people out into the world where there's a glut right now of jobs or job opportunities. And there's a lot of people applying for very few teaching positions. And these positions, frankly, don't pay a lot of money to begin with, certainly the adjunct ones. I think one is much better off to grab their career by the horns and say, I don't know where I'm getting all this bull by the horn stuff. You'd think I'm living on a ranch. Folks, there are no bulls here. Okay? There's not a bull in sight. No bulls. But I'm grabbing one by the horns anyway. And so I'm wrangling it. And I mean, it's being proactive will make you feel so much better about what you do.
Yes.
And you will respect yourself so much more. Instead of being in that passive waiting to hear, waiting to be approved of, we're back to that. You know, the whole thing about approval and permission. It's like, stop with that already. Be in control of who you are and what you create and where your income comes from. It sounds hard to do, but it can be done. Are you going to be a millionaire? Maybe not. But can you make money to support yourself, especially if you live modestly and don't get yourself into debt, which is something else we should talk about? Yes, you can. One of the things, I at my workshops, I actually address this, because I don't think people talk about money.
Not enough, right? And that's a huge issue of business.
Huge issue. And I don't think people talk about money and what it is to live within your means and all that, and credit cards and all that. So sometimes, often, I would say most, at this point, most of the workshops, the ASCAP Composer Career workshops that I do, I address this. I like to say, art isn't a four-letter word. Money isn't a four-letter word. Let's talk about these things, right? And one of the things about money is that it's very, very, money is freedom. My father taught me this. My father said that long, long time ago. He said he didn't care at all about money per se. He simply said what it is, it's a tool that gives you freedom. Mm-hmm. That if you have money, or if you don't have debts and all these things weighing down on you and responsibilities, you have freedom and you can make choices in your life. It gives you a lot of choice. The more freedom you have, the more choice you have, the more options you have. So I like to stress this by cautioning people. You know, student loans aside, I always say this, that's a very tragic thing in this country, that people have to take out ridiculous loans, especially if they're going into the arts. I mean, when are they going to be 48 years old by the time they pay one of these
I'm going to be older than that.
There you go. There you go. It's criminal. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have to revamp this whole system in the U.S. That's a whole nother discussion. We won't get into that. But student loans notwithstanding, because that's just an evil that some people are saddled with, and I feel for them. It's just a terrible situation. But when it comes to daily life and living within your means, renting or buying whatever, a place that you really can afford the monthly costs on, you know, finding a way to not have to go and dip into your credit cards to live, being able to pay as you go, live off your debit card, live mm-hmm. with the cash that you have, instead of always on the come, hoping that something else is going to come and balance things out, because that monster can get bigger and bigger before you know it very quickly. And with the interest rates and everything else, it can be scary. And that's a big weight to have on your shoulders mm-hmm. as an artist. Like you want to run your own business and have freedom. And so if you can do things that can lessen the burden financially for yourself, do them. One of the things, again, I'm the guinea pig for this. I have lived in two extremely expensive places, New York and LA. I now live in a place that is not as cheap as Nebraska, but it certainly is a fraction of the cost of either of those places.
Right.
And I'll tell you, it gives me great joy to not have to worry about expenses. It costs me half as much to live up here as it did when I was living in mm-hmm. California. And that's great. So I feel like I've just got breathing room what it means creatively. And this is where business, money, and creativity all collide.
Absolutely.
If you have breathing room, you don't have to take every single gig or smush them all really close together or whatever. I mean, I had this realization. I realized, you know, last year I had lined up a lot of gigs. I did a lot of writing. I'm very happy. All of it, great. Really different projects. But I don't have to do that. You know, it's like, what am I? I'm killing myself. And so I made a pact with myself that now, you know, at least for the immediate future, I'm going to space things out a little bit more. Why? Because I could afford to. What a wonderful thing to be able to say. And that's because one can live within one's means.
Yes.
I don't need a lot. You know, this is a modest place, obviously. You know, we're for those who are not here, we're in basically a glorified cabin on the edge of the rocks on the water.
It's a composer's dream.
It's a composer's dream, I would agree, but it's a cabin. There's no insulation. Do you know that? These are the outside walls.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, it's really... Well, you saw the Facebook videos. Folks, go to my Facebook page. You'll see the videos. It's hysterical.
Yeah.
The water comes through every one of these knot holes in the wood, and so I call it house stigmata. When we've got the walls weep. They just drip, little drips of water
visions
everywhere.
Of Virgin Mary
or something.
Oh,
it's hysterical. It's hysterical. But anyway, the moral, I just wanted to take a moment to say this because I obviously am passionate about it, and I want to help my peers just by suggesting that I'm a good poster child for this. You don't have to live in a huge city to have a career. You do have to be closer to a city than I am if you are a performer or a conductor. Mm-hmm. If you are a composer like me who basically doesn't perform, I mean, I speak and stuff, but that's by choice. But if your career is a little bit more like mine, you can live anywhere in the world. And that's a huge thing of technology to give us that.
Yes.
That's what a gift.
Wonderful.
Because the technology has led to artists being able to live affordably.
When I interviewed Michael Torkey for the podcast,
right.
he spoke about debt. And he had, this great New York apartment and a lifestyle that eventually he was working to just pay to live. And he sold everything and paid off his debt. And he spoke in the episode about the freedom that he felt as a creative, not just as a person.
Exactly.
And I encourage people to listen to that few moments. But this is what you're saying too.
Absolutely.
And composers, and not only is it about learning how to live within our means and within a budget, but how money works and what money is. Like you were taught, money is a means. It's not the object.
It's not the object. Exactly. It's not something to collect. Yeah. It's something to use to live well and to make sure that, you know, hopefully you can stuff a little bit away for that rainy day, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, Lord only knows what the economics of 2016 are going to be.
Right.
This is a very challenging
year. We can talk
year.
About what the Wall Street right. Journal is saying, right?
Exactly.
And, yeah.
You know, they're just be aware and wise with the choices that you make. That's all. Because they are choices.
Yeah, they
no
totally
one's putting
are.
A gun to your head to rent the much more expensive apartment as opposed to the less expensive apartment. You can write good music no matter mm-hmm. where. And if you want to write music in a beautiful place, hey, come to San Juan Island. You can afford the rents here. It's a lot cheaper than New York.
You, to kind of change corners here, you wrote a blog post or an article saying, call about making an asset out of
yourself. Yes, for New Music Box. That's right.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful article I recommend everyone read. And there's many points out of it, but the thing that really struck out to me is you mentioned in passing the writings of Seth Godin.
Yeah.
And
Kevin Kelly.
Kevin Kelly.
Right?
And I love both of them, especially Kevin Kelly's idea of 1,000 true fans.
That's right. I quote that one all the time.
And the idea that all you need is 1,000 people who are willing to spend $100 over the course of a year, which is not much, and it's not many people. And that is a more than substantial living.
That's right.
Can you elaborate on that? And then more specifically, can you recommend to the listeners, if they were going to get one Seth Godin book or read one Kevin Kelly blog, where would you have them start?
Oh, I don't know where to start. Because interestingly, I have to confess, I'm more familiar with their ongoing blogs, which are a treasure trove of information.
SethGodin.com. I can't remember what Kevin Kelly's
Kevin
is.
Kelly, the Technium.
Yes.
The Technium.com, I think it is. TECHNIUM.com, I believe. These guys are great, and there are others like them as well. They're not the only two, but they're the ones that come to mind. In this conversation, we're talking about them, and they neither of them are musicians, folks, and this is a very important point. You want to fill your life, obviously, with lots of things that aren't necessarily directly about music, but they're about wisdom, and they're about life,
and the business
and the
mind.
Business and the business models, and once you understand that these two guys are really sharp, they're very different from each other, and it's worth checking out their blogs and just scrolling back in time and learning. Mm-hmm. The blog post of Kevin Kelly's, which is from quite a number of years ago now, called 1,000 True Fans that you mentioned, it's when you think, folks listening, think about your Facebook page. You probably have over 1,000 people as friends. Many of you have thousands of people as friends, or combined with Twitter followers and SoundCloud followers and Bandcamp followers and, you know, name your social media here. Mm-hmm. You already, if you're a pro and if you're doing this, you already have thousands of people who know you, that you're in touch with. I'm not saying for a moment that every one of those people is going to spend $100 every year on you. Okay? I'm not saying that. However, I am saying that it's clearly within reach, that the concept of out of the thousands, plural, of people that we know and deal with on a regular basis, both in person and through social media, it's really not much to say that, you know, 800, 900, 1,000 people would be our clients and would be people, patrons on one level or another, either commissioning us, buying our stuff, buying the swag, they buy the mug, the t-shirt, the cap, whatever the thing is. The point is really well taken. I think too often people have the rock star mentality of success. They think, oh my gosh, I need millions of people to love me if I'm going to be a success. You know, I got to be Mick Jagger or Madonna.
Or Eric Whittaker, as the case may be.
There you go.
Right? Yeah.
But you don't. I mean, you know, great for all of them, but you don't need that to be successful. I'm proof of that, obviously. You know, you don't need to have all of that massiveness to have a happy and fruitful life and be able to pay your bills. You just need to be able to find people who believe in what you do. And that gets back to what we were saying earlier about putting what you do out there so that people can groove on it and dig it and hear it and love it and want more of it. This is one of the things that I've really loved about the band world, is that it's a very interconnected community. That when and again, what I'm doing, I do virtually entirely electroacoustic symphonic wind band pieces, which is very much off the beaten track for this. I mean, Steve Bryant and a couple other people do some of these, James David, but I think I can easily say I have more of these pieces in my catalog than anybody else, and it's what I'm known for. And it's a weird little genre. One would think starting out, and I can tell you the story about one of these first pieces, that like three people and a dog would buy this thing, you know, like there would be no market for this. And it's very heartwarming to say that there indeed is a market, not only for that, but for anything you want to do in that world. It's sort of like the mycelium of like the mushroom fungus under the earth. Everybody's connected. Everybody, it's amazing. It's this network, this living, breathing, you know, network that really loves new music and wants to support and nurture composers and play their works, and they can't get enough of new things. And for one of the reasons is, of course, it's a much younger art form. I mean, orchestras aren't quite so warm and fuzzy about us. They've got hundreds of years of repertoire.
Yes.
They've got their own issues. I don't pursue orchestras. It's not that I don't love them and don't love orchestral writing, but it's not where I feel comfortable.
It's harder to
get
the
performance. It's not a happy place for me.
Yeah.
But whereas band, choral, I think I've got a little premiere at ACDA coming up in February. These are worlds where people want to share, you know, music and joy and happiness and the thrill of discovering a sound that they like, and they want to let other people know about it. So that's a very good place to be.
And there's a less veneration of the past.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a place, and everybody honors and plays the classics, right? From Holtz and Del Borgo, all the classics.
But it's not static.
The
classics are played and programmed all the time, but they're played and programmed right alongside
brand
with all of us
music.
Who still have pulses.
Yes.
And we answer our email. You know, but Sousa has never answered an email in his life. I just want to say that.
Just saying.
You know, you can't reach him.
You'll interact with the band. And
Sousa never Skyped.
Right. In the episode that just came out last week, there was a young William Tate was talking about providing value as a composer. And you need to go that extra mile. And that's what you're saying, too.
Always.
Interaction.
Interaction
being
is
present.
Everything. Everything.
You know, being available.
Taking the reins. There is nothing passive about this business. Everything, the act of writing is not passive. You have to put your butt in the chair and write music. Everything about getting the music out there is not passive. There is nothing passive about this. And that's a great thing. If you want something passive, do something else and write as an amateur, which is great. The amateur is a great word. It means someone who loves what they do. There is absolutely no shame in not making a living from being a composer. That's something I also like to stress, is that for, you know, making a living as a composer and being a composer, you're still the same composer. In other words, it doesn't lessen you. It doesn't lessen your worth if you've chosen to make your living, you know, from another set of income. And still compose and still get performances of your work. You are no less a composer than those of us who are trying to support ourselves doing it. And too often there's a bit of a stigma against amateur composers or pro composers who are not trying to make a living out of it. I don't know how to phrase it. Again, to me, amateur is not a dirty word. It's a very nice word. Someone who loves it. And it's important to realize that doing this full time is not for everybody, but loving to write music could be for everybody.
And many of our best composers did not write full-time.
That's right.
I mean, Shostakovich is the shining example of the 20th century. He had a full-time gig as a scientist, right?
Yeah. And Charles Ives.
Charles Ives was selling insurance.
That's right. I mean, there's a bunch.
Yep. Yeah, it goes on. And I think on the flip side of that, though, Alex, is the mindset issue we have with making money.
Yeah.
And the idea of monetizing our art.
Right.
And so many of us have walls built up around that, and just the fact that you're charging for a piece.
I know. In this day and age, it's funny to me that people still are kind of aghast at that. That seems so indelicate.
Yeah.
So indelicate. How can you charge?
And then you get into the issues of pandering and playing to the lowest common denominator.
Which is, we all know that that's simply not true at all. I mean, this gets back to mindset. If you choose to see it that way, fine. But that is totally not how it is. I see what I do no different than, my husband makes these beautiful pieces of furniture and beautiful cabinets, right? He's a great woodworker, and he gets paid to create these wonderful things. They happen to be physical things, right?
Yeah.
And so what's the difference when I make a piece of music? It's not physical except for the score and parts. I've put in the same amount of time that anybody else has put into what they create, and we all deserve to get paid for what we do because we all have to eat. It's really simple. This is not a mystery.
We have to make a living.
We have to make a living. It's not a mystery. And there's nothing shameful or selling out or anything when it comes to making a living, doing the art that you do well and love to do. That I can't think of anything more wonderful than that, actually. To me, that's the definition of happiness, to be able to do the work you want to do and get paid for it. And the getting paid for it begins, that's a very personal thing. And people grapple with this, all of us grapple with it at different times in our careers, in our lives. It's, you get paid for it when you decide that you're going to get paid for it. Mm. And you get paid well for it when you decide that you're going to get paid well for it. And that
yes,
is a different,
and then you
it's a
raise
personal,
your rates.
Right,
yeah.
You raise your rates or you look at what the market will bear vis-a-vis what your position is kind of in the, in the world and the quality of your catalog and what you're doing. And that's a personal decision for everybody. There is no rate chart. There's no union for us. Meet the Composer, which is now New Music USA, came up with guidelines that are good, and I link to them on my site. They're certainly useful for commission fees, and they're still relevant, interestingly. But the bottom line is, it's a mindset that when you decide, it comes in waves. There's always the first moment in usually a younger composer's life when they realize, after doing a lot of pieces for free for their classmates or for other peers or whatever, they realize, oh, someone has just offered to pay me money for this. Wow. So there's always the first commission, right? And that feels great, and you feel very validated. But usually after that, you're still working for very low money and, you know, just piecing things together because you're starting out, you're building your catalog, and you don't feel that you have the background to be able to charge more. At a certain point, a few years go by, things happen in your career, hopefully, and you realize, oh, wow, I'm going to start asking more for what I do. And then you are always, it's a miracle. You ask more and people pay it. Wow. Yes. What a concept.
And yet we have this mentality of like, oh, I need to undercut.
Oh, that's the worst thing you can possibly do.
It totally is.
For two reasons.
Yeah.
First of all, when we price ourselves as professionals, I'm not talking about a 20-year-old at this point. You know, I'm talking about, you know, somebody who's working at this for their living. When you price yourself, you are also representing the field. And if you lowball something, if you say, you know, I'm going to do this concerto for piano and orchestra and ocarina for, you know,
$500
or, you know, $1,200 or whatever, oh boy, it's bad on two levels. One, you're sending a message that that's all it's worth, you know, and two, you're sending a message that, you know, that you don't believe much in yourself, that you don't think you're worth very much. But the other thing is, of course, if you start really, really low, when somebody asks you, which is often, it's a delicate dance. Often, you know, we can have agents and people be our in-between people for commissioning inquiries. But often, one is in the position where somebody says, I'd like this, what would it cost? You know, they just kind of ask you flat out in an email or whatever. And you have to think about how you're going to respond to that. And I guarantee you, you do not want to start low, because if there is any wiggle room to be given, you're going to end up lower than that. Mm-hmm. You know, don't start unrealistically high, because that's stupid too, and you know, you're going to price yourself out. But start reasonably high, to the point where if you needed to do a little wiggling to make somebody more comfortable, you know, you'd end up at still a very good rate. We can talk about this a little, because I have some advice for the listeners when
please,
it comes to pricing things. There are many ways that we can be paid what we need to be paid. We talked earlier about consortiums, about instead of one payment from one organization, it can be spread out among many. I mean, there's some consortiums with 30 members in them. I mean, I think the biggest one I've done is 20. It's like herding cats. But no, but I mean, there's always somebody, you know, in charge of it. But there's that. There's also, I make it clear when I'm talking about a considerable, you know, commission, something that's in the five figures, I make it clear that instead of the standard half up front, half in the back, if they want to space it out in three or four payments, that is fine too. And that takes some burden off as well.
Absolutely.
Being able to offer that as a payment option. There are, you know, there are a lot of ways to go about this to make it less burdensome. But often when somebody inquires about something that I know is going to be expensive, in my response to them, I will say what it will cost. I will suggest that I'm very happy to help them put together a consortium of a few other ensembles if they would like to, you know, ease the costs. And I also mentioned the fact that this can be done over a period of, you know, the payments can be made over a period of time. I think in reverse order, I say that first, and then I also bring in the others. And I make it clear that I'm part of the process and I want to help, that I'm their partner.
Yes.
And, you know, my goal is to write really good music for these wonderful people.
For them.
Right.
This isn't about you.
It's not about me. It's about them and their needs.
Yeah.
That's another good piece of business advice. What I was saying earlier about don't be narcissistic, it's not all about you, it's actually about everybody else, and stop thinking about you and your needs. Think about what it is that other people need. We think about that hopefully when we're writing the piece, when we're writing the commission, and we're thinking about it, you know, in other aspects of our life. So think about what they need to get out of something and work with that and make it work for you as well. This is a key point of doing business, and it's a key point of negotiating. My father was an attorney. He was a very well-known commercial real estate attorney, and he used to say, you know, a good negotiation is when everybody around the table feels like they've given something up and they've gotten something, as long as it's all equal. that they all feel equally that way. He said a bad negotiation is when it's lopsided and, you know, somebody feels that they that they've lost. So make sure that no one's losing, and especially, you know, it's your job to protect yourself. Yeah. But there are many creative ways to do things. Additionally, let's say an ensemble wants to commission you, but you realize they don't have the wherewithal to pay the money that you need for the project, nor are, for whatever reason, are they interested in having you help them, you know, gather around a few other ensembles. Another thing that I have had great success with is getting paid a lesser amount to do adaptations. Now, not every piece in your catalog is adaptable, right? But some are, and you can go through your catalog and look at what you've got, and usually one piece will pop out, and you realize, wow, you know, that would actually work really well for these people with a bit of nipping and tucking. I mean, you can't, it's not across the board, just copy-paste. It takes work to turn an oboe into a violin or whatever the hell you're doing, you know? It takes time. But I will come back with that kind of suggestion, and that's often very successful. And it still costs them some money, but it's within their ballpark of what they can afford. And that's, I call that a win-win. I get a new piece in my catalog. I get a new performance. It gets that music, which I already like and have already written. It gets it out there more. And they get a new piece that they can premiere. And I get money that I can pay my rent with. Wow, you know, win-win.
So for the young composer or emerging, and for many of us, we're just trying to figure this out. I mean, you mentioned these consortiums with 10, 12, 20, 30 members. How do you go about getting people in?
Right.
And how do you yank on your network in a way that's not turning people away?
Okay.
Please expound on how you've put these consortiums together.
For me, it came in the back door in a very interesting way. And I don't know, this has got to translate in some way to everybody who's listening to whatever your databases are and how you do business. When I did an electroacoustic band piece called Paper Cut, it's the only piece that I don't publish. It's published by American Composers Forum because it was done, it was commissioned for their wonderful BandQuest program, which is 20 years now, just about, that they've been commissioning one composer a year who's usually not in the band world, and I wasn't at the time, to write something for middle school bands and bringing very fresh repertoire, as you can imagine, into that otherwise, at the time, 20 years ago, kind of stagnant, you know, catalog. They've done a great thing. American Composers Forum, BandQuest, check it out. Anyway, when they set this up with me, I said to them, I think I'd like to make this an electroacoustic piece. And they said, fine. This is back to the conversation where I said, I think three people are going to buy this. Please forgive me ahead of time. And oh, by the way, it includes paper. I'm like waiting for them to just kill me. But they were great. They were absolutely great. And they gave me total artistic freedom to just do what I wanted to do. And ironically, it became a very big selling piece. I sell more copies of it now than I even did then.
Really?
Sometimes two a day. I mean, it's unbelievable. Wow. That piece has been done all over the world by not only
just out of curiosity,
and high schools, but by colleges and professional bands. It's
really
hysterical.
Just out of curiosity, what level is it?
It's a grade three.
Which means it's like accessible for all high school bands.
Right, right.
Yeah,
okay. Exactly. And it was actually, I think some of it, it's a little rangy. It was my very first piece for young people. And so I made some mistakes in it that I had them holding some notes, I think, too long. I wouldn't do that again. But they rise to the occasion. They do it. I always say you can play a couple things down an octave. You know, I put notes in the second and third editions of it to let people know it's okay to adapt it to suit. You know, you learn as you do these things.
Yeah.
But anyway, the story is, this is getting back to the database and consortiums, because this is an important one. When it was, I realized, I'm not, as you can tell by what I said before, I'm not someone to give up control. And I wasn't entirely comfortable with the idea of not having, even though this was going to be published by another company, and I adore those people, but I wasn't going to be publishing it, and I wasn't going to be controlling the sales or any of that. But I said to them, tell you what, I would really like it if either people would have to go to me for the download to the accompaniment track, which is what they have to do for every one of my other pieces, or at the very least, you guys can provide the download, I'll give you the track, but would you copy me on every response that you get? And Susanna Altman at ACF is fantastic. And every single time she responds, and it's a lot of responses, every time she responds on that piece, I get a copy. And what it enables me to do, and she puts this in her spiel to them, that, you know, you may be hearing from Alex and yada yada, and sure enough, they hear from me, and I write them a personal note, and I say, I'm available for Skype, and thank you so much, and yada yada, and give them a link to, you know, some supporting materials. And what happens also, this is what Seth Godin calls permission-based marketing.
Yes.
Permission-based marketing is when Somebody contacts you, when they come to you for something, you then have the right to add them to your mailing list, to your
yes.
Now, this comes, I think, with power, there is responsibility. And I do not send out any mailings to anybody. I haven't in a decade.
I'm pretty terrible at it.
I don't do it. I don't send out mailings to anybody, but I do build a database. So with Papercut and with all my other electroacoustic pieces, and of course any other of my pieces that are run through my company, when somebody makes a purchases something or you know has a download, let's say they buy it from Hal Leonard or J.W. Pepper, but they have to come to me for the download, I am able to build a little relationship with them, I hope, you know, and say hello and yada yada. And it's quite genuine. I'm just so delighted that they're doing the music and I'd love to be involved and Skyped in, whatever. And then I add them to a subset group on in my contacts. That's Concert Wind Band in this case. And so every time somebody buys something, boom, they're in there. And I make a note of you know, what piece they bought, which tells me what grade level. And, of course, their information, is it a high school, is it a college, is it a regional band or whatever, professionals. You do that enough times, and suddenly you have a lot of people in your contact base. When it comes time to put together a consortium of, let's say, 20 people, I can fund it in about 2 days.
Because, can you really?
Because what I do, and I also make a note, when I've Skyped with somebody, when I've done a Skype rehearsal, as I like to call them, I put that note in there, too. So when it's time for me, let's say if I wanted to fund tomorrow a grade 3 piece, I would type in, I'd do a search within that group of concert band conductors. I would do a search for Papercut. Up come all the people who've done Papercut. Then I do a search on that group, Skype Purcell, because those are the people that I've had the most direct contact with.
You have a more relationship.
And more relationship. It gets back
yes.
to relationship. And I look at that group, and then I write not ever, ever, ever a mass email. I write a personal email to every one of these people that I choose that I would like to have involved in the new project. And it's a personal, always a personal email. And it might be in the middle, it's a lot of the same information, but the beginning and end have specifically to do with my relationship with that band and that person and what they're up to, you know. And it's very important to respect and honor individuals and to not just send cookie cutter things. I'm always amazed when I see the cookie cutter thing come out, you know, blast out there. I just don't think that's the way to do business. I'm not saying it doesn't work for people, but I'm not comfortable with it. But
well,
that's how you asked how do I fund a consortium? It's built on relationships, and the relationships are built from the database or access, I should say, from the database. And that's why your database as a composer is a very, very important asset for you, because that's where the people are and the people who relate to you. They already have bought your music. They've already performed your music. Presumably they like you. So when you reach out to them and, hey, how are you doing? I'm looking forward to doing a new piece with, you know, CSNC or whatever. I was wondering if you might be interested in participating. And here's the skinny, I give them, you know, the rundown on the cost and the terms and whatever. And let me know if you'd like to be part of this.
So 8 years ago, could you have funded a piece in 2 days?
No, not in 2 days.
So the composer, no matter where they are in their career, who wants to get this started?
It comes from showing up. My first consortium was 7 bands, as I recall. I think there were 7? Something like 7 or 10. But that was, in large part, it was because the lead member, who I believe was Jerry Lucart of University of Minnesota, on a piece called Immersion, that one, he brought in, I think, most of the other schools. Because he and Tom Duffy at Yale, they both believed in what I was doing. Mm. And that's a big electroacoustic piece. It's a big symphonic tone poem for band. And in that case, that's where we are very fortunate to have the kindness of the people around us to support us. So they launched me. They were the ones that got that off the ground with a smaller number of places. And then that piece, people, you know, knew about it. I put it on a demo of a CD that I hand out to people. People heard it. It gets done a lot. And then Papercut happened, and that one really, you know, became better known. And so it was the luck of the draw that I was very lucky to have great people with me and the skills to collect the people that were coming into my life so that when it came time for the third piece, which I think might have been Tight Squeeze, but I'm not sure. I'd have to look at my catalog. when that came along, I was able to reach out personally to people. So you're not going to do it overnight, but you will do it over time. If you show up at conferences and meet people, Midwest Clinic is the best place in the world to show up and glad hand, to have business cards and demo
Chicago.
CDs. That's in Chicago in every the dead
December.
Of winter.
Every yep.
December, the week before Christmas. It is so, can be very cold there. It wasn't too bad, as I recall, this last year. But it can be bitter. But it's a great, great time. There's so much to be learned and so many connections and relationships to be built there. Friendships. I mean, these are real friendships. These are people with whom I stay in touch and I look forward to seeing every year. I mean, it's like camp for adults, you know. I've been going since 2008, since my first commission was out of the blue. Todd Addison of the U.S. Army had contacted me out of the blue on MySpace, back when MySpace was a thing.
Wow, that and was, Tom and, was your first friend. And,
Tom! Only people of a certain age would even know who Tom was. Tom was all of our first friend. And, oh my gosh. And it was Todd who said, "Have you ever heard of the Midwest Clinic?" And I said, "No," because of course I only knew chamber music. I didn't know the band world at all. He said, "You have to go to this." I said, "I only have one piece." It was the piece Homecoming that I'd written for the Army. Mm. He said, "Go." And I went and it opened up my world. No, it's true. Show up. I think it's like, this is an old adage. The key to success is showing up, right?
Yeah, yeah, being present.
Just be present. It's easy. And show up and smile. No whining, folks. Just smile.
All right, our time is drawing to a close.
Thank gosh. Anybody who has endured this whole conversation gets a medal.
Oh, my gosh. I bet people will listen to this many times because, Alex, you have provided so many nuggets of wisdom and value that I can't even process it. I'm going to have to listen to this myself.
You're very sweet.
You can edit
away on this. Thank you.
I'll cut everything else out,
Gary,
except for your laughter.
I like the laughing. Keep the laughing. But you are amazing to do this series and to want so ardently, as I share this with you, you know, to want to share anytime we hit our head against the wall and have it, you know, figured a little something out, we want to share it with other people so they don't have to hit their head against the wall. But that being said, we also know that the things that work for us don't necessarily, they're not cookie cutter, they don't work for everybody. And so everybody listening, take that with a grain of salt, that, you know, some of this stuff will apply, some of it won't, and it just, you know, use whatever inspiration is useful, but the main thing is enjoy it and love what you do and just be honest with yourself about what you're doing.
But as we go, I want to be super consistent. So I would like to ask you my lightning round questions.
Okay.
Before we get there, I have one very important question I want to ask you. What is one thing you could recommend to composers right now that they could do today to take their career to the next level?
I kid you not, it would be to lie down on their most comfortable sofa or bed, relax their body, close their eyes, and imagine what they love doing the most.
Visualize,
exactly. That's how every one of my pieces begins. It starts with visualizing, what do I want to say? And it's also how every one of my life decisions tends to flow, where I'll be lying down for whatever reason, lying down, try not to fall asleep. If you do, great, you needed the sleep. But lie down and visualize and create what you want. And remember how much power you have to make your life look like what you want it to look like.
I love this. You and I are of one heart.
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely.
All right, let's do these lightning questions.
Okay.
Are you ready? Okay, so first question. What advice would you give your 20-year-old self?
Don't worry so much about being approved of by others.
Good. You elaborated on that earlier,
I
so we're
sure
not going to go into that.
I don't
that.
Have to go into that, but boy, did that come right up quickly for me. That's like an emotional response. Like, I'm done with that.
And so many composers, myself included, this is something we all deal with. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is one habit of yours that you feel leads to your success?
I'm pretty disciplined in terms of scheduling my time of both business and writing. It's in the calendar. It gets done. I play a lot. I mean, I just came back from 3 weeks in Belize. I did some work, you know, every day.
You set aside an afternoon for this, which I can't thank you enough.
And I've got two big pieces too. But it's like, you know. But you prioritize. Make sure you make room for the important things, which this is everything in your life, and just balance it, and just make sure the work gets done. So I guess, you know, a good work habit is I'm reasonably disciplined about that.
Yeah, discipline. That could be a whole episode.
That's a whole episode.
What is an instrument you have always wanted to learn to play?
The cello. I love the cello. And my look at my hands. They're like baby hands. I barely reach an octave on the piano. It's amazing I play the piano at all. I have tiny, tiny hands, folks. And I can. And I tried to play the cello, and it hurt. It was just like,
really
hurt. I just, my hand position, whatever, it just didn't work for me. But I love the cello.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Everyone wants to play a string instrument, I found out.
And they're all crazy because, you know, have you noticed there are no frets on that thing? It's hard.
Yeah, oh,
like,
I know.
How do they find the pitches?
I'm well aware of my intonation issues. Thank you very much.
I always wonder how it is. I mean, to be a fine violinist, let's say, you have to have stupendous pitch. And how is it that anybody, young or old, can get to the point of being good when they're listening to themselves sound like a dying cow? I don't understand how that works. I never could get, I've picked up a violin. I've got an old violin in the back there. And I, you know, I'll do finger positions or whatever on it just to check things. But I've tried to play, and I sound so frightening that can't imagine learning the instrument. I couldn't listen to myself. I don't know. The bass is more forgiving. The bass can be a little.
Giving my secret away.
The bass can be a little more forgiving because it's woo, woo, you know, it just sounds great when it's a little off.
Yeah, but the pitch
all the
pocket
other instruments,
is a little bit
it's
bigger.
It's wider pitch pocket. But the other instruments, other string instruments, forget it. Not a wide pitch pocket there.
No, there's no. I mean, if that first violinist is off,
they're off.
Yeah. Okay. What is one composition you wish you had written, and why? I know this is a difficult question,
that
but just
is.
Name one off the list of hundreds.
Oh my gosh, I didn't prepare for this one. Anything by Imogen Heap.
Really?
Think she is so hip, and I think she is so creative. She's an incredible engineer. She has an incredible sound world.
She does it all herself.
I know. That's why she's my hero. And I mean, I would like to have written and produced anything of hers. I'd like to be her.
Name one piece so that the listeners can go to Spotify or Hoots. YouTube or wherever and just find
I was listening
it.
To, what is the album called? Oh, Ellipse? I'm getting it wrong. I'm bad with album
is
names.
Is that the one with, what
it's
was
It's Dark. It's
this,
a dark
the
cover
the famous
with a
cappella track of
yes,
hers.
Yes, yeah.
What is the name?
Look it up. We'll add this to the website, folks.
Yep, there will be links.
But anyway, she is awesome. Check her out. And I also am a big Radiohead fan, and I would go for anything that they do. I would like to have written. So.
What about Johnny Greenwood's film scores for the Coen Brothers films?
Yeah, really, really.
Incredible.
Yeah. I always remember years and years ago, many years ago in L.A., Esa-Pekka Salonen had mentioned in an interview that he liked Radiohead. And I think that suddenly they gave them a lot of cred in the classical music world was when he said it. You know, like, oh, okay.
Speaking of him, he did an interview on Alex Baldwin's podcast in December called, I can't remember what Baldwin's podcast is, but they talk about conducting and composing. And how he came to maturity as a composer. And if you haven't listened to it, Alex.
I will listen to it. That sounds great.
It's wonderful. And he talks about the balance he felt as a European composer in the new music school coming to America. And he's in New York. And then he comes to L.A. and he finds freedom to write what he wants to hear.
What a concept.
Yeah. Okay. Moving
what
on.
What a concept.
Okay. So what is one book that you could recommend for the personal, creative, or business development of the Composer on Fire audience?
Okay, you know what it would be? The Elements of Style.
By Strunk
and White. You know why? Because if you cannot write a proper email or letter, you're sunk. You have to understand the use of the language and proper punctuation and grammar
Absolutely.
To come across well.
And then just clear communication as composers, because we're asked so many times to talk about ourselves and our pieces.
That's
and
right.
if you can't, You, there's no relationship.
Exactly.
Where can people find you on the internet?
AlexShapiro.org. That's easy. The .org, folks.
And you're easily found on social media.
I am.
Well.
Go to my Facebook page. Be my Facebook friend. I want friends. I guess I'm just Alex Shapiro on Facebook. You'll find me there.
Yep. And I will link to her on the post on Facebook.
And I'm not a big tweeter, but I'd like to get more into tweeting. And so I'm at Alex_Shapiro, all small letters.
Yes.
So,
last thing here, as we sign off, this is your final soapbox. Do you have any final words of wisdom, or is there anything that you want to say to the composer who wants to do what you're doing, making a living writing music, what would you like to say to them?
Be honest with yourself about what you love to do the most and follow that path. And I'll use myself as an example. Years ago, when I left New York and left, I was studying at Manhattan School of Music, I left and went straight into the film and TV world in Los Angeles. Because at the time, in 1983, when I got to LA, that I liked film music very much. I was already doing some of it in New York. I was scoring some documentaries while I was in school. And one of my teachers was John Cogliano, and I remember poring over the score to Altered States with him. He had just come back from doing
which
is incredible,
score.
Right? And he encouraged, I got a gig lined up for me to do a direct-to-video thing in LA, and he encouraged me to go for it and to do it. And so I ended up for about 15 years doing film and TV stuff under the radar, very low radar stuff. But I was working steadily, but nothing to write home about. And then in the mid-90s, I realized how much I wasn't suited to that world, and I was never going to progress very much in that world. That what I had done a low-budget film that was all chamber orchestra, live players, no synths.
Wow.
And it reignited in me my love for chamber music and my love for working with live players. And at that moment, I switched my career over. I was not a spring chicken. I started doing concert music when I was about 37. So I have not been doing this since I was, 18, 19, fresh out of school. And so the lesson is that I did so much better in concert music, which one would think, how could you possibly be making money in concert music? You should be making money in film and TV.
But scarcity, competition.
Right, exactly. It sort of blows all that out in the water, because what I did, I followed my passion and I followed what I really loved to do. And by doing that, it was genuine. People relate to the fact that it was clearly something I loved, and then money got attached to it. What an incredible thing.
This is what you focus on grows, right? And Kyle Gann wrote an amazing, and I'm a huge fan of Kyle Gann and his writing, and it was influential in my doctorate.
Yeah.
But his inner article on you even said that you switched from a lucrative film career to a non-remunerative, that's the word he used. And that mindset alone is what composers have. We cannot be artists and make money. And you are breaking that mold. And
me,
I think,
and a lot of other people, sure.
It's possible, and that's what I'm out to do.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Don't ever go into anything. It's like what we were saying before with the, this is never going to work out kind of, attitude. Don't ever allow negative thoughts to invade the positive forward movement of your life. Just do the stuff you want to do. Some of it isn't going to work out, and that's okay. That's called being human. But much of it will work out, and much more of it's going to work out if we just say, hey, let's give this a shot. That's all you have to do. Just, hey, let's give it a shot. That's my biggest recommendation to my friends listening, is just give everything a shot.
Alex, I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Really appreciate you. I value you and your contribution, and I cannot thank you enough, and sharing your experience and wisdom, and anything we can do to raise the bar.
Yeah.
You live on the ocean, and you know what the tide is like, and let's raise the tide for all composers.
Yeah, exactly.
And you have done that.
A rising tide lifts
all ships.
Yeah. So
thank you.
Thank you, Garrett.
You've been listening to Composer on Fire, hosted by your Business of Composition coach, Garrett Hope. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a review on iTunes and make sure to head over to www.composeronfire.com to sign up for the Composer on Fire mailing list. Stay tuned for upcoming episodes of Composer on Fire released every week. And don't forget, be inspired, be creative, compose.